Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Susan Robb, and welcome to New Books in Children's Literature. And today we're talking about two books with Pamela S. Turner, who's an award-winning author of books for young people, particularly in the sciences. She has a Sybil's Young Adult Nonfiction Award and a Best Science Writing Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and also National Science Teachers Association and number of other awards. The books that we're going to be talking about are one's science, one's history, actually. And those are, the first is Crow Smarts, a book called Crow Smarts Inside the Brain of the World's Smartest Bird. That's has photographs by Andy Cummins and art by Guido Di Filippo. And it's the fifth book in Pam's Scientists in the Field series, published by Houghton Mifflin. Second book is a book called Samurai Rising, and it's the epic life of Minamoto Yoshitsune, and we'll talk about that. That is illustrated by Gareth Hines and published by Charles Bridge. So first, Pamela, thanks for joining me. And I wanted to start with crows. So,
Great.
First thing I wanted to ask you, you talk about, this is about New Caledonian crows, and you say that they deserve a spot alongside animals that we've known for a long time as, you know, unusually smart, like dolphins, monkeys, chimpanzees. And this talks about crows. So tell me about these crows and how do they compare with crows kids might see around in the U.S.?
Well, the New Caledonian crows are a little bit different than the crows here. But the thing that's very special about the New Caledonian crows is they evolved on this island, New Caledonia, in the South Pacific. And they took up the behavior of using tools. They used tools to get grubs, wood-boring insects, out of rotting logs. They used tools to kind of get into crevices between the leaves of plants, into little hidey holes. They use these tools and they stick them in and they pull out their prey. And now crows are very smart. They have what scientists would call flexible intelligence, meaning that they have that they are able to look at a situation and figure out how to solve the puzzle. And a lot of the puzzles that they're solving out is how to get food. And there are no woodpeckers in New Caledonia. Now here in the United States, the wood-boring grubs and insects are typically, they're taken by woodpeckers who have special adaptations for drilling into wood and getting the grubs and the other bugs that are under the, you know, that are inside the wood. But in New Caledonia, there are no woodpeckers. Woodpeckers never got to New Caledonia. It's an island. It's isolated. So the crows, being just generally smart animals, figured out that they could use tools. So in other words, they had this problem. There was food. It was a little hard to get. How do I get it? Well, they used brains over brawn to solve this problem. And they have been, these same New Caledonian crows have been captured and taken into captivity by scientists, and they've run cognitive tests on these crows who are able to solve some amazing problems, which I talk about in the book.
Now, so if I'm understanding correctly, so with woodpeckers, you know, just because of their beaks and that, they are, they would be able to go after this, but crows aren't designed that way, so they're having to
crows
do a workaround, right?
Yeah, crows don't have, it's a workaround. Crows don't have, they have a very all-purpose kind of bill. They're omnivores, so they eat all kinds of food. They're not specialists. So they have sort of the spork of bird bills. It's not great for any one thing, but it's pretty good for eating a lot of different things. But it's not hard enough. Woodpeckers have a very hard bill, and they also have special adaptations in their head that kind of cushions the pounding, so their brain isn't, you know, turned to jello by all the tap tap tapping that they do. So in the United States, woodpeckers tend to get those kind of food sources that crows in New Caledonia have figured out to get with tools. And they use the crows in New Caledonia are extremely inventive. They not only use tools, but they make and manufacture different kinds of tools. So in other words, they're not just picking up, although they will do this, they can just pick up a stick and poke, poke, poke. But they will also take a stick, or take a fork, little forked branch, and then they will clip off all the little bits, leave one hooked end, whittle the hook down so that they have a specialized hook tool and use that. They will also take, they'll also strip these long there's something in New Caledonia called pandanus, and these long leaves, and they have, they're sort of fat tropical leaves, and they've got a barbed, kind of a barbed edge on the leaf. So the crows will take and they'll tear pieces of this pandanus off, and it has this hooked edge, right? And so they'll use their strips of pandanus to poke into crevices to get things out. And because a tool, when they're using a pandanus tool is most effective. If, you know, if you're poking into a crevice, you want a thin business end, and then you want a wider end that's easier to hang on to. The pandanus leaves have strong, stringy things running through them, so you can't tear a pandanus leaf on the diagonal. But you can make it small at one end and fatter on the other end if you use kind of, if you tear it, cut in, tear it, cut in, and you create kind of a stair-step tool. And that's what the crows do. So it's a multi-step process that they do to design these tools to use.
So a couple things that jumped out at me. One was what you're talking about in terms of the tools, and I wanted to ask you a little bit how that compares to, for example, apes, chimpanzees, and that, and particularly though that the there's an aspect of this of passing crows passing what they learn on to the next generation, and that's something that we thought was what humans are particularly able to do. That's not, you know, that other species are not.
Yeah, so we know that there are other species that make modifications to tools. Chimpanzees are known. Some populations of chimpanzees will take sticks and kind of sharpen them on the end and poke them in crevices to try to stab at bush babies to get them out. So that's, and sometimes they'll modify if they're sticking a twig in to get termites, they'll modify it to make it a little more streamlined. So there are other species that will modify tools. There's not very many of them. The interesting thing about the New Caledonian crows is that because they clearly, there's some element of learning to this because these crows have been raised in captivity New Caledonian crows have been taken away from their parents. They hatched, away from their parents, raised by entirely by humans, and then they've been given these sticks and these pandanus leaves. And the crows do seem to have a natural tendency to pick up sticks and stick things in crevices. They do seem to have a natural tendency to tear at the pandanus leaves, but none of them can make a stepped tool. So that seems to be an innovation that was created by a crow and passed on to later generations of crows. There's the crucial thing that has never actually been proven in another species by humans is, can an animal take a tool, modify it, then another pass that tradition of usage down to another generation, and then that generation might make more better modifications. So cumulative tool evolution, does that take place? Now, that may have been what happened with the pandanus tools, but there's no conclusive evidence of that. But it seems that is what may have happened with the pandanus tool. And there's a long-running study in New Caledonia of the pandanus tools to see if scientists can document cumulative tool evolution, which would be quite astounding, because no other species besides human does this.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Let me ask you this. Do they also look at whether tools are shared? Do you know?
The sharing of tools, we actually saw a little bit of sharing when we were in the field. We were taking videos of the crows, and I have one of these videos on the website, and there was a juvenile and a parent working at the end of a log to get a grub out of the end of the log, and the parent drops the tool and the juvenile picks it up and it seems gives it back to the parent bird to continue using. Was that just the bird it fell, the bird reflectively picked it up and then the parent bird snatched it away, or was that a deliberate move on the part of the juveniles to hand the tool, as we would say, although no hands being involved, to hand the tool back to the parent? It's not clear what actually happened. Generally, the birds make their own tools because there's plenty of tool-making material around. It's not like there's any lack of leaf stems or anything. So usually they'll just pick up their own and make their own. Definitely evidence that they carry favored tools around with them, and if they're working on something, they'll take a tool and they'll be perching on a branch and they'll set it under their foot while they're doing preening their feathers, and then they'll take it out and fly off with it. So they seem to have favored tools sometimes that they will keep around for a couple of hours and fly from place to place and continue using.
Now this book is the fifth in the series. You did frogs, mm-hmm. gorillas, yep. Seahorses, dolphins. Did you have favorite scientists as heroes growing up? Was that something that you had early interest in?
I was always very interested in animals. I think it's just something that you are just kind of born with. My first memory is trying to pull this puppy that we had into my playpen by its ears. And obviously I like to think my animal handling skills have improved. But I've just always been interested in animals and how animals live and how they're kind of little alien nations, that they see things and experience the world in ways that are very different from the way we experience them. And yet there's some commonality, and I'm fascinated by that, what we can learn from animals, what we can learn about ourselves from watching animals. More importantly, what we can learn about them, what we can learn about other forms of consciousness. And that's why my last couple of books have been about intelligent animals. So I wrote about dolphins before this. I wrote about bottlenose dolphins in Western Australia, and there's a group of them that use tools, wild bottlenose dolphins that use tools. And so that's really interesting, and it's only this group of dolphins in this area that uses it. And it seems to be kind of a cultural thing. And so culture in animals is a really interesting topic. There seem to be some differences in the kind of tools. I don't talk about this much in the book, but there is some difference in the kind of tools that the crows in New Caledonia use in different parts of New Caledonia, which seem also to be local cultural variations. I just find that really fascinating.
Now, what are your thoughts about how science is taught in elementary school? Because that's the age, right, that you'd expect this to be used for.
Well, I'm not a teacher myself. I have three kids, and I just love the idea that in addition to what's going on in the classroom, that kids can have access to books like these, which take a topic and delve into it in far more detail than you would get in a textbook. And give it a personal edge so that you can learn about the lives of real scientists in the field. What do they do? How did they get to where they are? The different scientists that I've written about include Tyrone Hayes, who's a professor of biology at Cal, who was a kid growing up and he was always wandering around in the swamps catching frogs and catching snakes and keeping turtles in his backyard. And I talk about how hard it was for him coming from this small town in South Carolina and how hard it was for him to get to college and be successful there when he didn't feel he had many role models. And I talk about Gavin Hunt in the Crow book, how he was a farmer for many years and didn't even start college until he was 30. But he was really interested in animals. He was really interested in conservation. So I like being able to show kids that there are different paths to success in science. And there are many ways of many different kinds of scientific fields. You shouldn't be discouraged if you say, well, I took chemistry and I didn't like it. Well, there are plenty of other areas of science that you might absolutely love. And you don't have to feel like it's a dead end if you don't do well in one class. I want kids to understand kind of the breadth of scientific activity and the kinds of things that they could do if they would like to be a working scientist. I have Janet Mann in the Dolphin book, who was a girl and was inspired by the stories of people like Jane Goodall, who studied chimps, and she was one who discovered that chimpanzees were using tools, and how inspirational that was to her as a girl of a woman in science making incredible discoveries about animal behavior. And she grew up and did her own research with dolphins and made her own incredible discoveries.
Now, are there related experiments that kids could do, let's say, safely at home test out some of the concepts you talk about in the Crow book or in others?
Well, we give, and if you go to my website and for all of my books, there's a teacher's guide, discussion activity guide. So, I really invite teachers to go there and look at those guides. And there are lots of activities that teachers or parents can do with their kids that are around the theme of the book. I think that there's a lot that kids can do if they're interested in nature and interested in animals just by going outside and learning what's around them. What species of animals are in your neighborhood? Most people in the United States have crows nearby because crows do very well in suburban areas. They do well in areas where there's people. Crows are great to observe because they're larger, and so they're easy to spot. They're usually easy to find. You can hear them cawing. They're like border collies and monkeys. They're always doing something interesting. So you can learn a lot. So they're a really easy bird to start with if you want to do some bird watching and learn about animal behavior. So I encourage kids to just look and see what's around them and learn about what's around them. You don't have to be out in the middle of New Caledonia to find wildlife. I volunteer at a local wildlife hospital, and boy, we get quite an amazing variety of animals come through our doors. And this is all in a catchment area that's very suburban. There are a few hills, but without houses. But a lot of this is just animals that come through people's backyards, and you learn a lot about what's right in your own immediate area.
Now, one of the things you mentioned was about the outdoors, and I wondered, how would you compare your experience growing up with that of kids you talk to in terms of interest in science, the outdoors? Obviously, that comes up because of the internet and mm-hmm. even interest in research.
Yeah, well, when I was growing up, I didn't have the internet, and so that's an amazing resource because you can get on there, you can find videos about just about anything you want. On my website, if you go to www.pamelasturner.com, I've got a page for the crows, and I've got videos on there, so you can read my book, and then you can go to my website, and you can see videos of the crows making the tools. You can see an explanation. Dr. Hunt does an explanation of how the pandanus tool is made, so you can see that in detail. And I also put on just funny crow videos because people find crows doing all sorts of hilarious things, like sliding. There's one of a crow sliding down a roof on a kind of like a mayonnaise jar lid, and some crows playing in the backyard playing like these drooping branches, and they're using the swings. There's one of a crow just for fun riding on a windshield wiper that's going woof 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 woof. They're just such funny, quirky animals, and I think it's just there's so much more for kids to access now. And you can actually see very specific things. You don't have to wonder what a New Caledonian crow sounds like. You can go, you know, watch a video. You can hear them. And you can like, oh, that's quite different from the crows in my backyard. So it's just such a wonderful, rich environment for kids to take advantage of. And you can have a very specific interest and chase it a long way with all of the resources that are available to kids now. I guess the biggest difference is that a lot of kids today don't spend as much time. The converse of that is kids today don't spend as much time actually outside looking at things, playing out in the backyard, playing out in the woods nearby, playing in the swamp, whatever, like Tyrone did, out wandering around looking for frogs. So that's the kind of thing that kids today miss that I hope they will be inspired by books like this to go outside and see more and learn more about what's actually out there.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you talked about the website because it really is quite beautiful and there's a lot of information on there. So let me move to your next book, the Samurai Rising book. And is that a new age category for you? That's a chapter book.
I wouldn't say it's a new age category because the scientists in the field books are designed for 9 to 12, and the dolphin book is particularly long, and I think the dolphin book is definitely for an older reader in that age range because I used a pretty sophisticated style in that one. I think Samurai is for 10 and up, so it's really not that much different. Samurai is different just in terms of it's a long work of biography / history. So that was a little different for me. Although my first book was about Japan. My first book was a picture book called Hachiko, The True Story of a Loyal Dog. So I lived in Japan for 6 years, which is why I wanted to write Samurai. But I know Amazon says 12 and up, but the publisher says 10 and up. And I just saw some posts online of some teachers who were saying, you know, I've got a fourth grader read this and loved it, and I thought it would be too much for him, but he absolutely loved it. So, you know, it really depends on the child.
Yeah, well, it is terrific. I mean, it's fast-paced. There's a lot of drama.
Thank you.
You can see what would attract a reader, you know, the topically. One of the things in reading it, you can see how, harsh the extreme conditions that Yoshitsune faced growing up. And so when I was reading that, I was thinking, well, you know, logically that made him capable of enduring, you know, unbelievable hardship mm-hmm. and duress and battle, like he talks about when they, you know, when they're in the mountains and no one thought you could come down out of there, and yet he just mm-hmm. thought you could. What other qualities do you think played a key role in who he became?
I think the qualities that played a key role were the fact that he did not grow up among other members of the extended Minamoto clan. So he grew up totally in isolation, and he didn't actually get together with his brother, who was the leader of the the remaining members of the family until he was 20 years old. So he lived all, he grew up totally outside the family. And so he was, he grew up on stories, on hearing about how great his family was, but he didn't live among them. So I think he had this notion because he was never, he was a monk in a temple. He was living in, and then he ran away and learned to be a samurai, but he was living with another samurai in the north. He was basically a charity case. So this whole time, he's thinking, well, you know, I have this great family name, and I need to live up to it. I've been, I haven't ever lived with my family. He was kind of taken away and stuck in a monastery and taken away from his family just to kind of sideline him. And but he wanted to be in the thick of things. He wanted to be worthy of his great family name, this great family samurai tradition, and I think that drove him. Just the, and I think a lot of people can relate to that. You know, the, just the drive to want to be somebody, to want to live up to your own your ideals of what you should be. And I think there was a fundamental insecurity there. He never probably felt like he really belonged. He really wanted to, and that drove him to kind of the heights of military achievement.
So in a way, he set his own bar, and maybe he set it higher than it even might have been had he grown up under other circumstances.
Yeah, I think what, frankly, what made him great and what killed him was the fact that he had these ideals, and they were not very well based in reality, because as it turned out, his family was not quite, well, let's put it this way. I like to compare him to King Arthur and Luke Skywalker, because they're raised in obscurity, they grow up to become heroes, and then they discover that their worst enemy is actually a member of their own family. The difference is that Yoshitsune's story is true.
Now, with that, do you think that he was a man particularly suited for the time in which he lived? I mean, would it have been so, you know, so different? I mean, I guess it always would be. But what do you think about him in the context of the time he lived?
Yeah, I think he, I don't really, you know, we're 800 years removed from him, and we have to go on the sources that we have, and you have to sometimes read between the lines if you're looking at a historical figure from so long ago and try to interpret what they must have been like from their actions and what other people said about them. We have nothing that he wrote directly. We have none of his, you know, his words. He didn't leave us any, really anything directly. So this is all inferred, but I think he was a man of his times, but yet it's easy to understand his motivations. I think it's very easy to understand why he would do the things he did. So I think it's a story that transcends time and culture, sibling rivalry, ambition, pride. I think those are all things that we can all recognize. And that's what attracted me to the story, and that's what made me want to present it to an American audience, an English-speaking audience. I think it was often a delicate balance, because you want to talk about, there are things that happen that are really horrible in the book, and so you want to acknowledge that this is horrible and that the way they treated peasants was terrible. At the same time, you want to put him in the context of his times and say, okay, within the context of his times, he was actually, you know, he was actually pretty good to common people. But, I mean, that's a low bar given the way samurai behaved in the late 12th century. So there was always that dance between, you know, you want people to remember, if you're judging Yoshitsune, you're judging him by 21st century standards. And that may not necessarily be a fair way to judge him.
Now, the samurai are often seen as lone warriors. And so I was interested to know if you saw them that way. And also related to what you said about King Arthur, and you talked about Luke Skywalker, but to King Arthur, how would you compare the samurai and how they're seen in Japanese culture to how knights are viewed in Western culture?
I don't have enough depth of knowledge about Western knights, to be honest, to make a clear comparison. I would say that the most obvious comparison is that there's a tremendous amount of mythology about both. And it was very interesting for me in delving into the 12th century samurai to investigate not only what happened at the time at the end of the 12th century when this titanic civil war was happening, but also how did people view it afterwards? How did medieval Japanese view these events after they happened? It became really the national saga, and it influenced generations and generations of Japanese for hundreds of years. Just as the legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and all that inspired people in medieval Europe and, you know, in later centuries. And one of the things I do, if you go to my website, I added a page about Yoshitsune, and I have examples of how his story has been told and retold over the years in very different media, like Japanese puppetry, bunraku puppetry, and kabuki theater, and manga and anime and visual novels, and computer games, and how and art forms such as scroll paintings and woodblock prints. And I think it's amazing the way these stories influence us and the way we react to the story. So part of this is what I talk about in the book is what actually happened versus how these events have been remembered, which is also part of history. I think that when people are thinking about samurai and how samurai are perceived, one of the things I learned through my research is the samurai of Yoshitsune's time are different from the samurai of later ages, as you might expect. And so people's vision of the samurai, like as a lone warrior doing duels or something, that's the vision of the samurai from more like the 17th century, not from Yoshitsune's time. So it kind of depends, you know, the myth of the samurai is drawn more from later medieval times, or Edo period times, or even Meiji times, than it is from these late Heian period when Yoshitsune was active. And I thought that was interesting because you can see by looking at Yoshitsune at the very early period of samurai rule in Japan, you can kind of see where they started from and get a better sense of where they ended up.
Now, what about your thoughts on you mentioned games and how his story ended up in all of these different parts of cultural material, puppetry and theater and all of that. Do you think we glorify warriors too much to our children?
I think that we are social primates. And I think that we are irresistibly attracted to violations of social norms. This is my, you know, this is my animal behavior evolutionary biologist coming into the history project. But we are riveted by violations of social norms. The worse the violation of social norms, the more interested we are. That's why people enjoy reading about murder mysteries. If somebody wrote a novel about, you know, somebody's outdoor couch cushions got stolen, nobody would read it. It's just not interesting enough. You know, we want the stakes to be high. So I think that there's a natural attraction to extreme stories. We don't necessarily want to live in these times. We don't want to, hopefully, do these things that are done. We want to have a way of experiencing them without suffering from them. So we want to experience the full gamut of things that can happen to people without suffering the terrible consequences of some of the things that happen to people. That's why we like murder mysteries. That's why people watch Game of Thrones. You know, that's extreme behavior, and we are riveted by extreme behavior. I think to be interested in reading about extreme behavior is not to condone it. And I try in the book to put Yoshitsune in the context of his times and show how he actually exemplified the standards of samurai at the time. Those should not be the standards of our 21st century, but I think if you're going to learn about what happened, and if you learn about what happened in the late 12th century, it really helps you understand later Japanese history. You have to understand the samurai at the time, what their ideals were, how he met those ideals, how he kind of exemplified some of those ideals. And it helps to understand the culture and medieval Japan, who people idolized him. You know, why were these the ideals? Why were these ideals so important? I do think you have to look at how he exemplified the ideals at the time. And we are fascinated by samurai because I think we're fascinated by these extremes of human behavior.
Now, did you try and port, when you were looking at the samurai and looking at his story, did you try to portray it differently than in a lot of other places you'd seen? And were you looking also to make him a little more personal and more human?
Yes, well, what I did was I pulled together some of the major sources, which is the Heike Monogatari, the Tale of the Heike, which is a mixture of history and literature, the Zuma Kagami, which is the semi-official history of the Kamakura Shogunate, which was the very first shogunate in Japan, which was started by Yoshitsune's brother, Yoritomo, and so I pulled that together with other 12th century sources, diaries of people who lived at the time, writings from the time. And I also looked at a wide variety of academic sources that talked about the political situation at the time, the land tenure system, which ties into what happened a lot. And I wanted to, you know, just about the religion at the time, how samurai lived, other sources of stories about samurai. And what I did, which had not been done in English before, I pulled it all together into a biography and tried to pull away the layers of mythology. I acknowledge the layers of mythology, and I point out how they're chunks of time when we don't really know what Yoshitsune was doing, and those chunks of time have been filled in over the centuries by many storytellers who invented all these things that happen, which are very entertaining stories, they're just stories. But I mention those because they're very iconic, some of them very iconic stories in Japan. But what I wanted to do was kind of filter out, acknowledge some of the legendary stuff and say, yeah, they're legendary things. This is what we think we know happened. Obviously, this is 800 years ago. The gold standard for history is you want to have multiple sources independent of each other that are unbiased and lived as close as possible to the events that they describe. Well, 800 years ago, there aren't very many things that happened 800 years ago that you have a lot of sources that meet all of those. Those meet that kind of historical gold standard. So I talk about that in the source notes. When I had conflicts between the sources and the source notes, I talk about why I decided that this thing that happened was more likely than this other thing. But I wanted to pull together as much as possible and place him in his times and explain what was going on at the times, explain his behavior, explain other people's behavior within the context of the times, while also pointing out that some of this behavior was really pretty awful.
I wanted to ask you, too, sort of lastly on this area, about the illustrations. A couple things about that. First, I was interested to read that Gareth Hines had a longtime interest in Yoshitsune's story. And then so that made me wonder where you first came across his story. But also I thought it was interesting, too, that you both have black belts in karate. So having taken several years of martial arts, I both admire that and I'm a little jealous. But can you talk about that in terms of your coming across the story and how you think these illustrations do with the story?
Yeah, I think the illustrations are great. When I first conceived of this project, I knew I wanted it to be, I knew I wanted the book to be novel trim size, like the size and shape of a novel. I knew I wanted it to be art illustrated rather than maybe photographs of, I don't know, you know, old armor, things like that. Because I felt that this was really something that would benefit from an art illustration approach. Anything I could have put in terms of photographs of old objects would have been entirely, well, this is kind of approximate to what, you know, they wore at the time when Yoshitsune was alive. You know, this is what they wore in terms of their armor. Instead, I thought, well, if I'm going to have to approximate, because we don't have things that he owned, we don't have any portraits of him done at the time, well, we might as well give kids a better sense for what it looked like by doing art illustrations. And I knew I wanted the art to be kind of a cross between sumi-e, which is Japanese ink painting, and kind of a manga style, because I thought that would really kids would respond to that, because kids today, you know, really interested in Japanese culture and the mono anime visual novel stuff. And so I thought that would be a very appealing way to do it. I was really delighted. I didn't know anybody who could do that kind of a thing. Most of my books, science books, are photo illustrated, but I asked a friend, Jenny Holm, who does a series of graphic novels with her brother, Matt, and she knows, because she just knows more graphic novel people. I said, do you know anybody who can do this? And she said, oh, Gareth Hines. You should go, you know, you should think about Gareth Hines. I was like, okay. And I actually, when she said that, then I remember, oh, yeah, he does the graphic novel adaptations of Western classics. Yeah, he can do Arms and Armor. You know, he's done Macbeth and Beowulf and all this. And so it turns out that Charles Bidge, the publisher, they were independently also thinking of Gareth Hines. So this we were all on the same page. It was great. And luckily he was between projects and he was able to do it. And it turned out through talking to him, he has a, I think he's a third degree black belt in Aikido. And he had actually in art school had done some sketches of Yoshitsune and his best friend Benkei. He'd done to illustrate, it was more of a legendary thing, but he actually knew who they were, at least. He'd actually heard of the story before, so that was great. So I think that was a bit of a selling point for him. And I've been doing for the past 11, 12 years, I have been doing kendo, which is Japanese sword fighting, and I'm a first degree black belt in that, and I'm supposed to be testing in a couple weeks for second degree. So it was really interesting that we had this martial arts link, and the editor, Alyssa Mito Pusey, she also studies Aikido. She also has a black belt in Aikido. So yeah, it was kind of cool. We all bonded over a mutual martial arts thing.
So one thing I did want to say, sort of pulling these together in a certain sense, I mean, one of the things that struck me in a way you could say that they were both stories of brains over brawn, because
that's true.
Because Yoshitsune, we didn't really talk about that, but wasn't someone who, you know, looked like he was going to be a warrior on the field, and so that was part of the story there as well. So in general, would you like to talk in any way about that, but also what are your hopes for what kids may take away reading this and reading some of your other books, both about science and about history?
Yeah, I think it will. I hope it will give kids a greater appreciation for the natural world, in the case of the crow book, I hope it will give people a different way to look at crows, because a lot of people don't like crows. I, of course, think that's, you know, I think that's incredibly misguided. They're just such great animals. They're wonderful and smart and interesting, and I just, yeah, never get tired of looking at crows. I spend a lot of time at crows because I rehabilitate them for the wildlife hospital, so I had a crow upstairs in my aviary recently. So I really hope that will give kids a different way of looking at crows, different way of looking at animal intelligence, different way of appreciating the way another species perhaps can perceive the world, and also we can see some commonalities in our cognition. With Yoshitsune, I hope that kids will read the story and understand a little bit more about Japan, about the samurai, where they came from, where some of their standards came from. I like the idea of writing about it. If you write about an island nation at a fairly early stage of its development, obviously modern Japan is so tremendously complex, but if you go back 800 years, I think it's a little bit easier for kids to see the interplays of economics, because they talk about, you know, how the rice harvest failed and then they couldn't go to war, and I talk about a little bit about the land tenure system and how that drove the politics. In addition to all the stuff by Yoshitsune himself, I talk about kind of the technology of warfare, why the samurai used curved swords, why they were at this point in time, why mounted archery was kind of the definitive samurai tactic. And so I think it's if you take a small country like that at an early stage in development, it's fairly isolated, kids can see kind of the way politics and economics and technology and culture, religion, all these things kind of intertwine to create history. And I thought it was a really great microcosm for kids to see these forces at work and how those forces affect individual people. Yoshitsune I like because he has such an improbable story. And the only description that we have of him is that he's small, pale, skinny, protruding eyes and buck teeth. And one of the and I talk about that a little bit in the source notes. You know, if you were going to write about a hero and you were going to make stuff up, you'd probably make him look, you know, really big and brawny, and I don't know, you'd make him sound like super duper and handsome and broad shouldered and yeah, all this kind of stuff. But that's not what's come down to us. And since this is so contrary to a heroic ideal, that it's probably still in the narrative because that's true, because he really did look like that. And that I think is really, you know, interesting. So kids can say, well, here's a little scrawny guy. He didn't even have any samurai skills. He showed up wanting to be a samurai at a northern lord's home, and he was 15 years old, and he didn't know anything. And he'd been a monk, been training to be a monk, so he didn't have military training. And in those days, if you were a samurai, you start training when you were, you know, 6 years old. By the time you were 16, you were ready to go to war. So he was like, I talk in the book about, he's like, he was somebody who'd never played Little League, and he shows up at spring training for the Yankees. And it's incredible that he became a samurai and a leader of samurai and a very respected leader of samurai.
Well, I want to remind people where to find you. They can go to PamelaSTurner.com for your website. And also, thank you for joining me today and talking about all of this. The books are terrific, and I hope people will go look for them.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.